Hello and welcome to the Risk and Accounting Advisory Podcast. My name is Neil Began, partner in the Risk Advisory Practice here at Cherry Beckert. And on today's podcast, I'm thrilled to be joined by two of my favorites, Stephen Ursillo and Dan Sembler, both partners and leaders in Cherry Beckert's Information Assurance and Cybersecurity Practice. Today, we are going to be discussing SOC 2 reports and uncovering the true value of the SOC 2 that is becoming more and more prevalent, as we're all aware. What this means for your organization, as well as your customers, and quite frankly, if you haven't already, how you can get started. So looking forward to the conversation, as both Steve and Dan have spent years performing these examinations and helping clients meet their compliance needs while also driving value and guiding clients through an efficient audit process. So gentlemen, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Neil.
Thanks, Neil.
All right, well, let's jump right in. Start at the beginning. Steve, I'm going to start with you. If you could please explain the specifics of a SOC 2 report and maybe the differences between a SOC 1 examination and a SOC 2 audit.
Sure. Thanks, Neil. So SOC 1 and SOC 2 reports are both attestation reports that were developed by the AICPA to assess reporting on controls related to service organizations. They are both attestation engagements, which means they are the highest level of assurance a CPA firm can provide. And mainly there's a couple of different differences between the two as I kind of step through each one of them. But, you know, a SOC 1 focuses on financial reporting. It's often used to assess the impact of a service organization's controls related to the financial statements of its customers and or user entities, right? So it's driven on financial statement assertions. A SOC 2 focuses on more operations and compliance. So when you think about controls related to security, availability, processing integrity, confidentiality, or privacy, which are in fact the five trust service categories, it's a broader range of controls and really drives down to specific aspects of what's needed to meet service level commitments. You know, typically, like I said, around security or privacy or such. You know, in many cases, a SOC 1 would be more applicable to user entities, such as like a, you know, a customer of a payroll processing provider or something like that, where they're concerned about the materiality and the impact of the numbers or the transactions that they're receiving from that provider, and making sure that they're complete and accurate based on, you know, their financial statement expectations and assertions. Whereas the SOC 2 is used in a lot of cases for diligence. It's used for vendor risk management. It's used mainly by organizations, once again, to demonstrate their maturity on the service level commitments that they have. So that's a big part of the two. But when you talk about a SOC 2, and obviously there's been a fair amount of growth in the SOC 2 space, but it provides a lot of flexibility to customers in reporting on their controls and giving a certain level of depth and transparency on those controls related to their service level commitments. And those service level commitments can span across the criteria that we mentioned. In addition, if they have additional criteria that they need to report on, so let's just say they're in the healthcare space and they got to deal with HIPAA, or they're in the government contracting space and they have to deal with NIST 800-171 criteria, which we all know is CMMC level 2 base criteria, right, for handling CUI, they have the ability to do what's called a SOC 2 plus. So they can map the requirements and the criteria expectations for those third-party reporting framework or reporting expectations into their SOC 2, which provides a whole level of depth and transparency that can be used by their, whether it's regulators, whether it's business partners, whether it's their customers, or even key stakeholders of the organization. So those are some of the bigger differences. Both reports, and I think Dan will probably talk about this in a little bit, but both reports offer a type 1 and a type 2. You know, where the type one is really on the accuracy of the description in SOC 2 based on description criteria and the design of the controls. And in a type two, we get into not only the description, accuracy of the description and completeness of the description, the design of the controls, but also the operating effectiveness over a period of time. So in summary, what I tell people, SOC 1, financial reporting, SOC 2, operations and compliance.
No, it makes complete sense. And thanks for the detail. And you mentioned some of this, obviously, in your answer, but maybe just sum up. You know, how, in your opinion, performing a SOC 2, how does it benefit an organization and add value? And I know, again, you touched on some of the SOC 2 plus and the ability to incorporate in other frameworks and so forth. But if you had to sum up, what would you say in terms of benefiting organizations and adding value?
Okay, yeah. So like I said before, it provides a lot of insight and transparency on a particular system including the system's boundaries, right? So if an organization has a particular system that their people, process, and technology that they're solutioning to fulfill obligations, it allows for them to report on their internal control structure. A SOC 2 is really a report on internal controls, right? It's not a prescribed framework, so to speak. It does have criteria, right? But it allows for an organization to demonstrate the governance, risk, and compliance measures in their internal control structure based on what's called COSO. It fulfills the service organization's expectation in the way in which that the user entities can get the depth and transparency, not only on what systems are involved and how they're executing and who's responsible, but also the key elements of the controls that match back to their risk mitigation strategies in using that provider, right? So things that they would expect, multi-factor authentication, certain levels of change management that they would expect, incident response, so on and so forth. So they have the ability for them to look at these reports and get some depth on what some of those best practices are. In addition, it also will help them prescribe how they interoperate with third parties. So they're what we call subservice organizations. Maybe they're using a cloud provider. Maybe they're using a managed security firm that's doing MSSP, so on and so forth. So you can see what other upstream boundaries are included or excluded in what we call carved out, and where those particular elements of control and responsibility lie. It also gives the user an understanding of what things they need to do potentially to fulfill their service level agreements and help maintain the best level of security in working with that provider. It definitely helps build trust, with customers, business partners, prospects, regulators, key stakeholders, mainly because there's a certain level of maturity that's going to go around having these reports, right? And able to demonstrate the ability to meet and execute on these controls for operating effectiveness is certainly something that builds trust, and it's shareable, it's legible, and it's something, like I said, that people get on a regular basis. It's also used to manage customer and third-party compliance initiatives. So if an organization has a particular regulatory or contractual requirement, they can specify that within the actual SOC 2, and then they can demonstrate their regular the relevant controls in order to meet those obligations. So as I said before, maybe something along the lines of HIPAA security, breach notification, and privacy requirements, they'll be able to identify what specific controls they've identified to meet those obligations. It's a great risk management tool for third-party risk management. So customers can use that in their vendor diligence programs, and it can provide a competitive difference. If you got two providers that you're lining up to use for a solution, and one of them has demonstrated that maturity and the ability to meet its service level commitments, it's going to give a competitive advantage over someone who doesn't.
Yep, absolutely makes sense. And Dan, did not want to forget about you here on this podcast. And I want to come to you with this next question and recognize the bar has been set with those first two answers from Steve. But
sure,
assuming based on Steve's answers, we've got companies on the line thinking, well, I actually do see the value add there, and we could benefit from several of the things that Steve just talked about. How would a company even go about preparing for a SOC 2 audit?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know we'll talk about process through this conversation as well, but just at the start, right, just as you're beginning the process, there's some background education that has to happen, right? Number one, CPA or SOC 2 reports have to be issued by CPAs or CPA firms, right? But obviously the subject matter that's underlying the report is typically more focused in IT controls, security, privacy, compliance, and operations, as Steve was saying, right? So you're looking for a firm that has a broader range of talent that isn't necessarily limited just to the CPA, right? So you're looking for teams that are made up of, certified information systems auditors, the CISA, right, or certified information system security professionals, the CISPs, right, as well as various other deeper bench strength, could be cloud certifications or anything else that's going to help your audit team better understand the environment that they're auditing against. It's ultimately going to lead to a better product, a better report for your team, a higher value. After finding that team, there is a process to go through the readiness assessment and identify the key components of the reports. And we'll get into that in a few minutes, I think. But just as you're planning, just know the difference earlier, as Steve had alluded to, the difference between a type 1 and a type 2 report and the long-term requirements that are going to be requested of you from either your regulators or your business partners or your clientele for which type of report you need, depending on the coverage that they're seeking to obtain from you. For high-level purposes of this discussion, the way we typically break it down, a type one is an auditor's report that's going to cover the completeness and accuracy of the description criteria. I'm sorry, the completeness and accuracy of the system description in accordance with the AICPA's description criteria, DC 200, as well as the design and implementation of controls to achieve the organization's trust services commitments or other requirements they may have. A type two, conversely, is the same thing as a type one, but it extends the audit auditor's opinion to cover a period of time. So you're covering operating effectiveness as well. Very briefly, there is an additional option for something called a SOC 3. Basically, it's a further extension of a SOC 2 report that is intended for a broader distribution or a broader audience. So the discussion, the scope, the boundaries, the controls are written at a higher level that's meant more for a public consumption in a SOC 3 versus a SOC 2 that's going to be much more in-depth, much more detailed in providing insight into the organization's policies, procedures, people, process, and technology to achieve their service commitments.
Yep, that makes sense. And sometimes, obviously, a SOC 3 is more digestible, to use that term, by some of the folks that would be requesting that information. And there's some advantages to be able to provide that in certain circumstances versus the full detail of the Type 2.
Absolutely.
So let's stay with kind of components of a SOC 2 report. So every SOC 2 audit, the end deliverable is a report that, you know, kind of have the four required sections and a fifth optional section. And recognizing we're on a podcast, just trying to, in layman's terms, if you could kind of summarize what those four required and fifth optional section are in terms of what people can expect to see in the end result that is this SOC 2 report.
Sure, absolutely. And the good news is, you know, SOC 2 as a reporting framework is relatively standardized in that the expectations for what the users are going to see in a report is relatively consistent amongst different organizations that are issuing them, right? Because the language and the requirements is prescribed by standard, right? So what you're going to see, as you mentioned, right, four required sections in a SOC 2 report. The first one's going to be the auditor's opinion or the independent auditor's report, right? It's going to cover a summary of the scope of the engagement, what was included. It's going to make references to subservice organizations and user entities if they are relevant to that environment. It's going to discuss the auditor's responsibilities as well as draw the line between the auditor's responsibility and management's responsibility. Management's responsibilities obviously being the coverage or the performance and design of internal controls. It's the auditor's responsibility to assess the design and operating effectiveness of those controls. That's all baked into the opinion. And obviously at the end of that opinion is, depending on if it's type one or type two, where you see the specific language about the completeness and accuracy of the system description, the design and implementation of controls, and the operating effectiveness of those controls over a period of time, if it's a type two. That's all within the auditor's opinion. That's the first section, right, that's required in a report. After that, you have management's assertion. Again, a required element. All of these sections are required by standard, but management's assertion is it's almost like a reconfirmation of what the scope of the report is. It provides their statement that the controls and the setting the boundaries of the report and any underlying risk assessment or control activities are management's responsibilities. They're reasserting that through management's assertion. And they're also going to say, to their knowledge and belief, you know, to the extent that they have, that they are aware, right, that their controls have operated effectively over that period of time, if you're doing a type two. After that, required element number three is management's description of the system. This can vary in length depending on the complexity and the size of the organization that's reporting. But just know for the moment that there are nine disclosure criteria that underlay the requirements for the system description, right? Those requirements are going to cover everything from high level, you know, what is, again, the scope of the report? Where is the infrastructure hosted? Is it a report covering an application or a system or an infrastructure or a platform or all of it combined, right? It's got to draw the boundaries there, super important, as well as more tactical discussions around if they had identified any security incidents during the period. And if they did, was there an impact to their ability to achieve their service commitments or other requirements? There's discussion in that system description about the people, process, and technology that underlays their protections, right? And as the auditor, we're actually required to do almost like a reconciliation between the system description, right, that's in Section 3 of the report, and the controls that we eventually end up testing to make sure that they reconcile, right? That assertions that management makes through that system description are observations that map to procedures that are performed by the independent auditor, right? For example, you'll see system descriptions talk about the encryption of data in transit using a certain protocol, or TLS 1.2 or something like that, right? If that's an assertion that's made through the system description, we would probably call that a service commitment, right? We've got to make sure as the auditor that we have controls in Section 4 for procedures that we perform to validate that those protocols are in place. So that's all in Section 3. Section 4 is where you have the explicit mapping of the criteria, as well as the controls, and the summary of the procedures performed by the auditor and their conclusions. Lastly, I know this is a long section, right? You had made reference to an optional section at the end. Section 5 is technically an unaudited section of the report that gives management of the service organization the ability to respond to exceptions noted, if there are any in the report, or just to give other information that they deem applicable to their user entities. Could be mappings to other control frameworks, could be deeper insights into a business continuity plan, something like that.
That's excellent. And just to kind of sum up, if I could, these days, that was a lot, but very important, as you mentioned, that this is in every SOC 2 report. So for folks listening that may use some of the larger, maybe cloud service providers or, you know, third parties themselves and getting their SOC 2 reports, these should be fairly familiar and fairly consistent, as you mentioned, from almost a prescriptive nature in terms of how these reports are laid out. And there's some required sections, but kind of that first one, auditor's opinion. Second one, management's assertion, which, oh, by the way, something that we are able to help with, as you and Steve mentioned during the readiness process, helping develop that management's assertion for clients, as well as helping them develop management's description of the system, which is really their heaviest lift of the report. There's some required components, as you mentioned, for that section of the report, but something that during the readiness phase, we can consult on in terms of appropriate level of detail and what is needed to meet those sections. And then number four is really the criteria, the results of our testing to support that opinion. And then that last section five, as you mentioned, is an unaudited section, can be used for things like responding to any issues that were identified. You know, if there is mapping to some of the other widely established frameworks, as Steve mentioned earlier, that is something that section five can be used for additional information above and beyond the scope, but it is unaudited. And we would disclaim that in our opinion if that was to be used. So, good deal. All right. Well, let's stay with the report just for one more question. In terms of the process, what does the report process look like?
Yeah. So you're typically gonna start off a process if you haven't issued the report before with a readiness or a gap assessment. That's where Cherry Beckert, in this case, can help your organization identify the applicable service commitments as well as underlying controls that can be tested in support of those commitments. Those commitments also have to be mapped back to the trust services criteria, depending on the applicable categories that Steve had alluded to earlier, right? And that's all information and mapping that we can help with, right? That's all done through that readiness or gap assessment process to make sure the organization has the appropriate control level and coverage for the service commitments and control criteria that are selected. As you had alluded to, Neil, yes, we can help draft and kind of mock up system descriptions. It is management's ultimate responsibility to own that system description, but we can help in a scribe's capacity, right? Make sure that all of the disclosure criteria are achieved and that the system description properly reconciles and maps back to the controls that are in Section 4. That's all during that readiness process. After that, you're back at your decision point. You go to a SOC 2 Type 1 as of a period of a specific point in time, or do you go straight to Type 2 to cover a period of time and operating effectiveness?
Yeah, I think that's important to note for listeners that the Type 1 is not a requirement, meaning the natural progression from a readiness assessment, also not required, heavily suggested, though, I would say by us and really any other CPAs providing this, that you don't jump, you know, headfirst into the deep end right into an audit opinion by way of an actual report and start with the readiness assessment. But important to note that Type 1 is optional, meaning folks can go from a readiness assessment directly to a Type 2, as you mentioned, versus going always from a readiness to a Type 1 and then a Type 2. Is that correct?
Absolutely. That's exactly right.
Cool. All right. Okay. So bear with me here for a second, kind of a long lead into this question. I'm coming back to you, Steve, make sure that you're still on your toes here. So we obviously know with more organizations outsourcing significant components of their IT systems and infrastructure to outside service providers, it's something that you've mentioned in prior responses. It's become more critical for stakeholders, not only customers, but obviously regulators as well, in order to be confident that, you know, the service providers have implemented adequate security controls. So any final thoughts for our listeners as they prepare for a SOC 2 or even those companies going through the readiness process already? And I'll go to Steve for that one.
Danielle, absolutely. So I'm going to take a step back and just talk from a broader perspective and then bring it back in. Dan did a very nice job covering kind of the overall process around the readiness and then getting into the SOC 2 reporting initiatives. So I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, inherently, the boundaries are blurred, right? So the use of third parties, transaction processing across different providers, and the interoperability of the systems is obviously creating a pretty sophisticated and difficult, difficult boundaries in order to navigate because of all of the third parties that are involved. So vendor management becomes huge, right? Not only managing your own systems, but how they interoperate with those other systems. So it is critical. So getting started with cyber compliance, and like I said, taking a step back, it's a complex task. It's essential for organizations because they need to protect their data, they need to protect their assets, and really solidify their operations. Cyber crimes are consistently occurring, and the threat landscape is evolving pretty quickly, which means those related costs are also going up. I mean, statistics come out every year on the cost of a cyber breach, so on and so forth. So it's a pretty decent chunk of change. So some of the things to think about for organizations as they step into this journey is really, number one, identify the key stakeholders. Who's got the vested interest? Who's going to be responsible for the cybersecurity and or privacy risk management initiatives? This could include IT professionals, legal, compliance, senior management, I mean, you name it, middle management, so on and so forth, that's going to be involved in these initiatives. It is a governance kind of scenario. So it's going to be across an array of different subject matter experts, as well as people who need to deliver on this. You're going to want to gain that leadership support and get the executive buy-in. It's definitely going to provide value, but there's going to be a cost associated with it. Then you want to engage or identify the compliance experts that are going to help you. You know, folks that have been around this area for a period of time, that have dealt with complex environments in different industries, that have the technical expertise as well as all of the industry knowledge that you operate in order to execute on it. Making sure that you understand your regulatory environments. In many cases, organizations will, you know, go down the SOC 2 journey, but they don't necessarily take into account critical regulatory expectations that inherently are expected in their SOC 2s. Even though it's not a certification, it's not a certificate of compliance, but it's really just demonstrating the right controls around certain initiatives is something to consider. You have to identify the assets that you're protecting and making sure you know the data, the classification of the data, depending on if it's privacy for personal information or confidential for confidentiality, so on and so forth. And knowing, once again, where those boundaries are, where that data is stored, processed, and or transmitted. Then you're going to conduct your risk assessments, right? So basic security 101, just making sure you're identifying inherent risk and all the risk related to your service level commitments and how you operate, defining the controls and setting up the best way of executing those controls to manage a tolerable level of residual risk. You're going to basically define your objectives and your scope, and you may even decide, hey, I'm going to bring in certain frameworks that I know that will add value to my cyber or risk privacy risk management governance program. So while I'm doing the SOC 2, I'm going to concentrate some of these efforts on mapping back to ISO 27001, maybe the NIST cybersecurity framework, in certain cases, maybe key controls that are, you know, the CIS controls, so to speak, things like that. Once you've kind of identified that framework, it's time to really mature the policies and the procedures, implement the controls, monitor and test, and then of course have the right plans and testing for incident response, so on and so forth. And one of the key things where we've seen organizations really gravitate towards a heavy level of success is ensuring consistency through training and awareness, right? So people know how to execute, they get prescribed runbooks, they know what to do in certain situations, and that's, that enforces consistency and maturity throughout that process. And then typically, you know, there's always a continuous improvement process with every audit, sitting down with the teams and saying, hey, what worked, what didn't work? What can we do to improve this process? How can we make this more efficient going forward, but also continue to provide value? And then here's the big one. Report the overall results back to your leadership and your key stakeholders. As you go through these very detailed prescriptive exercises and you start to gain an understanding of the risk assessment process and the maturity, you have to communicate to the board of directors. You have to communicate to your audit committees, so on and so forth. So they understand, once again, big picture, appropriate audience, right? What this is providing, what decisions can be made, and how this translates to business risk. And what it can do, obviously, for the organization strategy. So starting with that well-defined plan, coming up with the right framework, maturing that process, making sure that those compliance initiatives are thought through and consistent, having the right folks executing on it, and then key communication to leadership and the stakeholders.
Excellent. Wow. Such a wealth of information on today's podcast. I really want to thank you, Steve and Dan, sharing your knowledge on SOC 2 audits, the process. I also want to thank our audience for listening. We ask that you please check out cbh.com/guidance for on-demand recordings of our recent SOC 2 webinar, where we unpack the specifics of the SOC report, the benefits, and how to prepare for an examination, and much, much more. We hope you'll check it out. Also, for more information on SOC reporting, information security, and cyber risks and mitigation strategies, we ask that you visit cbh.com/cyber. As always, please like, share, and subscribe to the Risk and Accounting Advisory Podcast. And thanks so much again for listening.